Welcome to Peak Water, why clean, safe water could soon be as valuable as oil. Here's a paradox for you. On planet Earth, we never really use or lose our water. Remember your fifth grade science class about the water cycle? It's always recaptured somewhere, in some form. And yet, having enough fresh, clean water is the single greatest crisis facing our civilization today. If water doesn't really disappear, you may be asking yourself, then why is there a crisis? You may have heard of the term peak oil, but have you ever heard of peak water? It may well turn out to be even more serious than peak oil. In this report, you are going to learn why. Few people are fully aware of the threats that water problems pose to the population at large. Most of us take water for granted. We assume there will always be enough. Sadly, there isn't. We assume it will be clean. Equally as sad, it isn't. All across the United States and around the globe, more and more people are coming to the stark realization that fresh, clean water is a finite resource. An insatiable thirst. Of the entire water mass on our planet, only 0.62% of it is fresh water, and most of that is in a very deep lake in Siberia. When you look at it that way, it's clear that America's thirst for water is a problem. We use water at a staggering rate. According to the National Academy of Sciences, the average U.S. household uses, you ready for this? 200 gallons of water per day. That was back in 1999. Now, 12 years later, we're using about 350 gallons, a 150 gallon increase per household per day. Do a little more quick math. For the 112 million U.S. households, you ready? That adds up to 39 trillion 200 billion gallons per day, a 57% increase in just a decade. In the next decade, we're going to need even more. And where do we think it's going to come from? The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has made a worrisome announcement as recent as in 2009. Quote, in the last 5 years, nearly every region of the country has experienced water shortages, end quote, they reported. Quote, at least 36 states are anticipating local, regional, or statewide water shortages by 2013, even under non-drought conditions, end quote. In the western United States, we're gulping up so much water that the Colorado River no longer flows to the sea. More water rights are parceled out to U.S. cities and farms than the river can actually supply. Only about 10% of all the water that flows into the Colorado makes it as far as Mexico. After traveling about 1,400 miles, carving out the Grand Canyon, and providing water for farms and cities in 7 states, just 30 miles south of the border, the mighty Colorado River has dwindled to a canal only 3 feet wide. Choked with sewage, fertilizer, pesticides, toxins, and salts leached from the farmland, it ends in a knotwork of muddy rivulets at the base of the Sierra de Juarez Mountains. The Rio Grande, too, is so tapped out that it lapses to a mere trickle and then vanishes into its old sandy bed just 300 feet away from the Gulf of Mexico. Do you think we're running out of fresh water? Draining the underground oceans. Groundwater is water that seeps underground into aquifers. Aquifers are giant underground sponges made of porous soils, including sand, clay, and rock. Now, they absorb and hold the water that soaks in from rain, snowmelt, creeks, rivers, and lakes. The amount of groundwater available is reflected in what's called the water table. You know this is the depth at which water is found in the soil. The water table varies seasonally depending on local conditions. But 40% of fresh water used by U.S. cities comes from the wells that tap in to these aquifers. Approximately 15% of Americans get their water from private wells that are drilled deep enough to compensate for the seasonal variations in the local water tables. For example, the local water table might rise to a height of, let's say, 25 feet below the ground surface during the winter. But during the summer, drops to 40 feet below the surface. To compensate, the well is drilled to a depth of 85 feet. That way, water is available year-round. But drought and overpumping can quickly drain even the biggest aquifer. When that happens, wells go dry. Makes sense, doesn't it? If the drought continues and the usage is unchanged, drilling deeper is only a stopgap measure. It takes years, if not decades, for nature to naturally refill an aquifer. According to the United States Geological Survey, there are only 61 principal aquifers in the continental United States. Many, such as the Cambrian Aquifer in the Chicago and Milwaukee areas, were relied upon heavily in the mid to late 1800s for fresh water. Now, during the 1900s, they were pushed to their very limits without being allowed to recharge sufficiently. Consequently, many U.S. cities began running out of water between the 1960s and 1900s. The solution? Because you had to limit the pumping of the aquifers, now they needed to draw water from the local rivers, lakes, and reservoirs instead. Beginning in 1900, the city of Brooklyn, New York, pumped water from its aquifer for 60 years, and at such a high volume that the water table level, you ready for this, fell below sea level. Because the aquifer soil was sandy and permeable, seawater began migrating into the aquifer. In order to ensure the fresh supply of water, laws were passed in 1965 to stop pumping the aquifer for public supply. Today, New York City's water supply travels hundreds of miles from lakes and reservoirs through huge underground pipes into the city itself. The Ogallala Aquifer, also called the High Plains Aquifer, provides water for South Dakota, Nebraska, Colorado, Wyoming, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, even New Mexico, and it was first tapped in 1911. Since 1950, nearly 80 wells per year, think of that, 80 wells per year since 1950 have been sunk into it to meet the demand for fresh water. It currently provides about 30% of all U.S. farm irrigation and 70% of the water used daily in Kansas. Since 1980, water levels have dropped as much as 150 feet, depleting a full 6% of the aquifer. The USGS data indicates that the average saturated thickness, which is the thickness of containing of the water, of the entire aquifer in 1992 was about 190 feet. In Nebraska, the average saturated thickness was 340 feet. But you ready? In Kansas, only about 90 feet. Some estimates calculate that 6% of this aquifer will be used up every 25 years and that it is being depleted at a rate of 12 billion with a B cubic meters per year. For the semi-arid landscape of the High Plains, it means that when the water is gone, the wheat, corn, and soybeans will shrivel and the ground itself might begin to collapse. Yes, collapse. Think about it. The technical term is subsidence. Underground water helps to hold much of the ground surface. If too much water is lost, it affects the surface ground. For example, some cities use aquifers as underground reservoirs. While it seems a sensible approach, it can have bizarre consequences. In the Los Angeles area, so much water is pumped in and out of underground aquifers that much of the landscape rises and falls more than 4 inches each year, heaving the ground up and down 100 times further than normal seismic activity. Think about it. It's almost like taking in a breath of the human chest. Rises up and back down. Up and back down. From fall to early spring, officials pump water into the underground aquifers for storage, raising the ground, like you're taking in a deep breath. And in the summer months, the ground shrinks as the aquifer is drained to water lawns, wash their cars. Come on, everybody in LA needs a clean car. Top off the swimming pools to bathe and to satisfy the thirsty 14 million residents of Los Angeles. Some aquifer soils are kept in place by groundwater fluid pressure. If more water is pumped out than can recharge the aquifer, the ground around it begins to slump, forming a cone-shaped depression. In this instance, porous subsurface soils ultimately collapse and compact and then are unable to hold as much water as before. Sinkholes, you've seen them on TV, they develop when caverns that had held the water can no longer bear the weight of the ground above. They cave in, abruptly tearing holes in the ground surface. Sinkholes tend to occur in Florida, Texas, Alabama, Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Pennsylvania, but they also appear in areas where natural aquifers are manipulated for water storage. Sinkholes are sudden, unpredictable, and can range in size from a foot across and 5 feet deep to over 100 feet or more wide and 300 feet deep. Think about that. Because of the way they are using the aquifers, Los Angeles water officials may wind up destroying not only a safe place to store the city's water, but parts of the actual city itself. But how safe has the water been anyway? Bitter waters, 5 pervasive poisons. America has some of the most majestic rivers in the world, moving billions of gallons of water thousands of miles down mountainsides, across plains, and through forests all the way to the ocean. Chances are you've driven by one and see the birds and fish that depend on their wide brown waters for survival. But would you drink from one? While many cities utilize groundwater wells for some of their water supply, nearly 2/3 of all U.S. municipal drinking water comes from these rivers and lakes because demand has depleted the aquifers they've depended on in past years. River and lake water, however, is not as pristine as water from aquifers. Agricultural waste and factory chemicals have been dumped into rivers and lakes for a century or more. DDT, found in every human being. One of the most infamous chemical pesticides, DDT, was extensively used in the 1940s and 50s because it seemed perfectly safe to animals, but deadly to insects. Farmers used it on corn crops, in barns, and in feedlots to kill insects. Cities sprayed it around schoolyards to kill mosquitoes. DDT is colorless. It's a crystalline solid with a weak chemical odor. While it resists dissolving in water, it dissolves easily in fats and oils. This means that DDT readily accumulates in the tissues of animals. Even worse, it concentrates by a factor of 10 million times as it travels from water to plankton to small fish, and up the food chain to larger fish and birds. DDT is also readily absorbed into soil and can remain potent for up to 3 decades. Now, while DDT is not outright toxic to animals, the higher concentrations that accumulate in animals have disastrous side effects. In the case of the bald eagle, for example, DDT caused eggs to form with thinner and thinner eggshells. As a consequence, fewer eagle chicks were hatched, and the bald eagle very nearly went into extinction in the 1960s and 1970s. Though banned from some use in the U.S. in 1972, California condors still show concentrations that affect their eggs because their prey feeds at the Montrose Chemical Superfund cleanup site. Among humans, DDT has a 6 to 10 year half-life. Simply means that the concentrations drop about half every 6 to 10 years. And in 2005, the Centers for Disease Control detected DDT in all humans. Although levels showed that they were dropping, DDT has been linked to diabetes, as well as developmental neurotoxicity in infants, even leading to miscarriages. Because DDT does not dissolve in water, it tends to remain in one place where it is easily absorbed by the organic content of the soils. It can persist in that place for years. However, there are some contaminants that do very well in water, and they spread anywhere. One such contaminant is hexavalent chromium. Hexavalent chromium, the Aaron Brockovich chemical. Hexavalent chromium, or chromium-6, is used for leather tanning, fabric dyes, explosives, stainless steel, and corrosion-resistant coatings found in tanks and pipes. Between 1952 and 1966, Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, used this chemical to prevent rust inside its cooling towers and its natural gas compressor site near Hinckley, California. Coolant water was stored between uses in unlined ponds, which allowed the contaminated soil to seep into the groundwater, creating a toxic plume 2 miles long and nearly a mile wide. Among factory workers, hexavalent chromium is known to be a carcinogen, particularly when inhaled, but it is also known to damage the digestive system and kidneys. In 1993, a legal clerk named, you know her, Erin Brockovich, there's a big movie done about her, researched illnesses in Hinckley linked to hexavalent chromium and helped sue PG&E. In 1996, PG&E settled the case for $333 million, the largest direct action lawsuit in U.S. history. Unfortunately, Hinckley isn't the only town with carcinogenic drinking water. Since that time, the Environmental Working Group has found 31 U.S. cities, 31, that are contaminated with what has become known as the Erin Brockovich chemical. At least 74 million Americans in 42 states drink chromium-polluted tap water. Chief among the most contaminated towns are Norman, Oklahoma, Honolulu, Hawaii, and Riverside, California. While the EPA has yet to set a safe level for hexavalent chromium in water, an EPA draft toxicological review found that hexavalent chromium in tap water is, quote, likely to be carcinogenic to humans, end quote. And look, the EPA hasn't gotten around yet to setting what those safe levels will be. Recent research has shown that hexavalent chromium in drinking water can pass more of the substance than was previously thought possible directly into the tissues of the gastrointestinal tract, the blood, the liver, the kidneys, even your spleen. Current proposed levels in California are 0.06 parts per billion, or ppb. The recently measured level in Norman, Oklahoma, you ready for this? 200 times higher, at a staggering 12.9 parts per billion. Now remember, current proposed levels in California, 0.06 parts per billion. Currently today, in Norman, Oklahoma, 12.9 parts per billion. In the meantime, Brockovich began investigating a case of contaminated water in Midland, Texas, where hexavalent chromium has been used for hydraulic fracking of natural gas shales. At this writing, over 40 families in Midland are without safe drinking water. The contamination, which has already spread 1.5 miles from ground zero, is spreading through their aquifer at 1,000 feet per year. Despite the dangers of fracking, the Energy Policy Act of 2005 exempted hydraulic fracking from the Safe Drinking Water Act. Well, isn't that just peachy? Perchlorate, the culprit behind the thyroid disease epidemic? Watch any kid's face explode with the wonder when they watch fireworks on the 4th of July. Then tell them they have just seen one of the deadliest toxic substances fly directly over their heads. Perchlorate, an explosive main ingredient of a solid rocket and missile fuel, is used in fireworks, flares, pyrotechnics, ordnance, and even explosives. Every time they are used, perchlorate is released into the air and the water around them. The chemical contaminates drinking water supplies, groundwater, and soil in hundreds of locations in at least 43 states and affects 20 million Americans. It interferes with the thyroid gland by decreasing the production of thyroid hormones, which are needed for prenatal and postnatal growth and development. In adults, the thyroid regulates not only metabolism, but mental function as well. Hypothyroidism is fast approaching epidemic levels in the United States, affecting an estimated 27 million Americans. Perchlorate lasts indefinitely in the environment, and it has been found in the big water fountain of seven states, the Colorado River. A 2010 study of 500,000 California newborns reported disrupted thyroid function in infants whose mothers had been exposed to drinking water with at least 5 parts per billion perchlorate. In January 2011, California adopted a 1 part per billion as its standard. Massachusetts is the only other state with a perchlorate standard, 6 parts per billion. Only recently has the Environmental Protection Agency agreed to begin regulating perchlorate. Its standardization process is expected to take 2 years. Could there be anything more important for the Environmental Protection Agency to focus on? Volatile organic compounds. You cannot avoid them. While a rainbow in the sky after a storm usually promises a nice sunny day ahead, an iridescent rainbow on wet pavement is far from good news. It usually means that gasoline or another toxic organic compound will be making its way to a local water supply near you. Volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, include gasoline, paints, and plastics. Many are present in the average American home and in the form of solvents such as glue, paint thinners, and lubricants. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that 42 million Americans use groundwater that has either been contaminated or is at a risk for low-level contamination by these VOCs. The three most common are chloroform, percolate, a solvent, and the fuel additive MTBE. Chloroform is the most frequently detected compound during these USGS tests. It's detected more frequently in urban areas, wet climates, areas with septic system use, and Resource Conservation and Recovery Act hazardous waste facilities. It is a byproduct of water municipal treatment where chlorine is added as the final step to killing bacteria before releasing it into the environment. Chloroform forms a chlorine-containing compounds that break down. It can also form from chlorinated swimming pool water or water used with household cleaning products containing chlorine, such as bleach. Since chloroform is terribly volatile, most of it formed by chlorination evaporates into the air as it is released into lakes and streams. However, chloroform that seeps through the soil into groundwater can remain unchanged for many years. Aquifer contamination also happens when chlorine is poured directly into a private well to shock, if you will, the system and kill harmful bacteria. Once in the aquifer, chloroform forms and spreads over long distances into other water outlets. Inside your body, chloroform circulates to all parts of your body, such as fat, liver, even your kidneys. Because it is volatile, it quickly leaves once the exposure ends. Chloroform affects the central nervous system, the brain, the liver, the kidneys. After a person breathes air, drinks liquids, or eats foods containing large amounts, breathing 900 parts per billion for a short time induces fatigue, dizziness, even headaches. The same exposure over a long period of time can lead to liver and kidney damage. One study showed liver enlargement of 17 of 68 workers exposed to chloroform at concentrations of 10 to 200 parts per million for 1 to 4 years. Think about that. Livers enlarged in 17 workers. There is no conclusive evidence of miscarriages in humans, but miscarriages and birth defects occurred in pregnant mice and rats exposed to only 300 parts per million. There was also an abnormal sperm formation in males at this exposure level. Long-term consumption of chloroform in chlorinated water caused colon and urinary cancers in mice and rats. Because of its link, the EPA has listed chloroform as a possible carcinogen. A 14-year-long USGS study of 932 public supply wells. A 14-year-long USGS study of 932 public supply wells that drew from 30 regional extensive aquifers showed that chloroform was present in 64% of their samples. And then there are the cleaning solvents. The problem with chemicals used as cleaning solvents is that they need to be strong enough to dissolve a variety of organic stains. As a result, they are powerful substances that don't just go away very easily. PCE, also called tetrachloroethylene, is one of the most common of these solvents found in groundwater. It is a colorless, non-flammable liquid with a sweet, ether-like odor that is used for dry cleaning fabrics and degreasing of metals. It dissolves greases, oils, and waxes without affecting the fabrics or leaving a corrosive residue on metals because it readily evaporates and breaks down. PCE is also used to make chlorofluorocarbons and is an insulating fluid and cooling gas in giant electrical transformers. It is also an ingredient in aerosols, solvent soaps, printing inks, adhesives, sealants, paint strippers, paper coatings, leather treatments, automotive cleaners, polishes, lubricants, and silicones, and the list goes on and on. Because PCE is so volatile, it usually evaporates quickly. In water, however, it's a totally different story. PCE dissolves only slightly in water and has a density of 1.66 grams per cubic centimeter. Water has a density of 1.0 grams per cubic centimeter. This means that PCE sinks quickly into the water and passes quickly below the water table. It can spread quickly into aquifers and may form concentrated pools below water if there is a large amount present. Plants and animals living in environments contaminated with PCE can store small amounts of this chemical in their bodies. Currently, the maximum contamination level, or what's called the MCL, has been set at 5 parts per billion. Long-term exposure may damage the central nervous system, the liver, even your kidneys. The American Cancer Society says that studies demonstrate evidence of a possible increase in the risk of lung, breast, and colorectal cancer among residents with the highest exposure to PCE. However, some other studies have not found such a link, which makes any conclusion about cancer a bit premature. The National Toxicology Program, which is made up of the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Food and Drug Administration, all have classified PCE as, quote, reasonably anticipated to be a human carcinogen, end quote. The National Research Council's report, meanwhile, helped back the EPA's February 9, 2011 reclassification of PCE as, quote, a likely human carcinogen, end quote. One of the most commonly detected compounds in both urban and rural areas is the gasoline additive MTBE. MTBE is a volatile, flammable, and colorless liquid that mixes easily with water. In the United States, it has been used in gasoline since 1979 as an anti-knock additive to replace tetraethyl lead. Because MTBE mixes so well in water, when gasoline with MTBE is spilled at gas stations by consumers pumping gas or leak from the station's underground storage tanks, it can very easily flow into groundwater and down into the aquifers. If your water tastes and or smells like turpentine, then MTBE is present at levels at around 20 to 40 parts per billion. In 1996, the city of Santa Monica, California, learned, to its dismay, that two of its drinking water well fields, Charnock and also Arcadia, were contaminated with MTBE at levels as high as 610 parts per billion and 86 parts per billion, respectively. The two well fields were shut down instantly. Residents in the city were faced with the task of replacing a full 50% of their drinking water supply. Little is yet known about the long-term effects to human health, but the substance was banned for use in fuels in 2002. Currently, MTBE is classified as a potential human carcinogen in high doses. USGS tests indicate tens of thousands of MTBE-contaminated aquifer water wells are distributed across the country. Organic wastewater contaminants, drugs in your water. In March 2002, the U.S. Geological Survey released an alarming study. in 139 waterways in 30 states, downstream from treatment plants and animal feedlots, minute amounts of antibiotics, hormones, pain relievers, cough suppressants, disinfectants, and other products were present in the water. The study, the National Reconnaissance of Pharmaceuticals, Hormones, and Other Organic Wastewater Contaminants in Streams of the U.S. 1999 to 2000, showed that 82 of 95 organic water system contaminants were present in over 100 streams tested. Think about that. I'm going to read this title again. The National Reconnaissance of Pharmaceuticals, Hormones, and Other Organic Wastewater Contaminants in U.S. Streams of the United States. And the report is just for 1999 to 2000. What was it in 2000 to 2001 when this report showed that 82 of 95 organic wastewater contaminants were present in over 100 streams tested? Specifically, the most commonly detected of these contaminants were as follows: coprostenol, which is a fecal steroid, cholesterol, which is an animal and a plant steroid, DEET, which we all know is the insect repellent, caffeine, which is a stimulant, triclosan, which is an antimicrobial disinfectant, a trichloroethyl phosphate, which is a fire retardant, and a 4-nonphenol, a non-iconic detergent metabolite. And of these 95 contaminants, 33 are known or suspected to be hormonally active, which in turn makes them oral contraceptives. 46 are pharmaceutically active, like antidepressants, indicating that these drugs are not being fully neutralized by water treatment plants. In September 2008, the Associated Press National Investigation Team revealed that after a 5-month study, there was a vast array of pharmaceuticals, from antibiotics to sex hormones, had been detected in the drinking water supplies of 24 major metropolitan areas. Over the past 5 years, the number of U.S. prescriptions has risen 12% to a record 3.7 billion, while non-prescription drug purchases held steady at around 3.3 billion. Veterinarian drugs also played a role. Pets are now treated for arthritis, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, allergies, dementia, and even obesity. Feedlots tack ear implants onto cattle that slowly release trenbolone. Trenbolone is an antibiotic steroid used by some bodybuilders that cause cattle to bulk up prior to sale. But not all this hormone circulating in a steer is metabolized. A German study showed that 10% of the steroid passed right through to the animals. And if it passed right through to the animals, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out where it's going to end up. While these pharmaceuticals were detected in very small concentrations of about one part per billion or less, and do not have any exposure ratings, two or more of these chemicals are typically found together. The USGS report found 34% of its streams tested held 10 or more of these chemicals. This fact is particularly ominous because it is not known how these substances and their chemical interactions in drinking water might affect their toxicity, nor is it known what the long-term effects of low-level consumption of hormones and antidepressants, or the combination of these and other medications, might be. Sudden destruction, accidental spills. The slow drip, drip of rocket fuel, solvents, and pharmaceuticals trickle into our water supply over time. But they're not the only substance that can poison the water. The water supply is also threatened by spills of various kinds. Spills typically, but not always, dump large amounts of contaminants during just a single event. Derailments, a carcinogenic cargo. 100 tons of high sulfur coal, 10,000 gallons of diesel fuel, 30,000 gallons of ethanol, 25,500 gallons of benzene, 17,000 gallons of pressurized chlorine gas, 17,600 gallons of corn syrup, 20,800 gallons of hydrochloric acid, 18,000 gallons of sulfuric acid. No, these amounts are not the amounts hauled by a whole train. They are the capacities of individual railroad freight cars. Railroads use unit trains to transport raw materials in bulk to industries. Instead of having one or two different kinds of cars in a train, there can be up to 100 of one car type hauling one type of cargo, such as coal or corn syrup or ethanol. A 100-car unit train of coal heading to a plant would move 10,000 tons. A 50-car unit train of corn syrup or ethanol would transport between 880,000 and 1,500,000 gallons. Unfortunately, when a derailment happens to a unit train and there's a spill, it's not just a few hundred gallons, it's normally thousands of gallons. Railroad tracks are laid on raised roadbeds with ditches on either side to channel rain runoff away from the tracks. These ditches eventually connect with gullies or creeks or seep into the groundwater just below the surface. During the first minutes of a big derailment, thousands of gallons of hazardous material can wash down these ditches and wind up in the local water supply before authorities have any chance to react. Now, the effects of groundwater from massive spills, well, they last for years. On Sunday, December 6, 1970, the town of Leroy in Genesee County, New York, was shaken when the Lehigh Valley freight train derailed. 1 ton of cyanide crystals spilled onto the ground, as well as 35 gallons of the metal degreaser TCE from two ruptured tank cars. TCE odors were detected 8 days later in the basement of a building 200 yards away from the crash. In spite of cleanup efforts by the Lehigh Valley Railroad, TCE was also discovered in two private wells in November of 1971. By 1990, TCE had contaminated 50 wells, affecting 2,115 people within a 4-mile radius of the original site. Think about that, from 4 miles away, and years later, still affecting 50 wells. Leroy has been an EPA Superfund site for over 40 years. But derailments don't happen all that often, right? Wrong. Because there are more cars and more powerful engines that pull longer trains, there are more derailments. In 2006, the Federal Railroad Administration reported, you ready for this? 2,194 derailments involving 728 cars carrying hazardous materials. By 2010, derailments topped 1,197 with 406 cars carrying hazardous materials. Even though there are fewer accidents, there is still an average of 3 derailments every day. Recently, on February 6, 2011, 28 tank cars, each containing 30,000 gallons of ethanol, derailed and exploded in Northwest Ohio. The fire burned furiously for 2 days, consuming most of the estimated 840,000 gallons of fuel. While the EPA reacted swiftly in setting up chemical booms to stop the ethanol spread in a nearby creek, it is not yet known how much may have seeped into the groundwater. Ethanol fuel is also sometimes denatured by adding benzenine. Benzenine is a known carcinogen. Well, you know what happens when manure spills? There goes the neighborhood. Waste from farm animals are never treated. Think about that for a minute. The waste from farm animals are never treated. Smaller livestock operations compost manure and spread it on crop fields or in meadows to fertilize the ground. Now, large agribusiness operations that generate millions of gallons of animal waste, that's another story. This manure, loaded with antibiotics and growth hormones, is stored in pits below animal confinement sheds for later processing or pumped into lagoons to break down and decompose. Unfortunately, as the saying goes, effluent happens. Manure lagoons provide an inexpensive way of treating huge amounts of animal waste. Waste from the cattle sheds and milking parlors are pumped through pipes into the lagoon. However, lagoons are exposed to weather and are affected by erosion and burrowing animals. That's something I wouldn't have thought of. Piping that is not buried deep enough below the frost line can freeze and burst and leak into the groundwater supplies. In Walkersville, Maryland, a manure lagoon pipe at a nearby dairy burst and contaminated the town's water supply in 2008. On August 15, 2005, 3 million gallons of liquid cow manure poured into the Black River when a reservoir wall at one of New York's largest dairy farms gave way. Roughly a fourth of the size of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill, the contaminated waters affected several communities in the Adirondack region. A 21 million gallon manure lagoon at a dairy farm outside Sonomish suffered a, quote, catastrophic failure, end quote, in April of 2010. It released large quantities of manure into the surrounding fields and then into the French Slough and into the Snohomish River. Now, both hog and cattle manure spills are fairly common, although cattle manure spills seem to be more prevalent because dairy farms are more widespread. Cow manure is likely to contain E. coli bacteria, which can make people ill. Symptoms can appear within hours or days after infection and include diarrhea, vomiting, and fever. Fortunately, under normal operating conditions, most municipal water systems can successfully kill E. coli bacteria. The residual hormones, however, are another story, and all bets are off when a tidal wave of Guernsey goo is heading downriver from their water intakes. Runoff, muddying the waters even more. One thing that can make spills harder to clean up is rain. Whether it's a chemical solvent spill from a derailed tank car or manure from a feedlot lagoon, rain can wash contaminants into nearby rivers and groundwater. But spills aren't the only contaminants that rain carry into your drinking water. Fertilizers, insecticides, or herbicides, or weed killers are chemical compounds that are sprayed on corn crops and eventually washed down into water supplies. Atrazine is both an agricultural and a home herbicide used to kill broadleaf plants and grassy weeds. It is sprayed to control weeds in corn, sorghum, and even Christmas trees. In the United States, atrazine is one of the most widely used herbicides, with 76 million pounds of it applied each year, primarily in eastern Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio, all of which are major watersheds for the Missouri, the Ohio, and the Mississippi River systems. Atrazine does not dissolve very well in water at all, and it is a common and widespread contaminant in rivers, reservoirs, and aquifers. Concentrations as low as 0.1 parts per billion have been shown to alter the development of sex characteristics in male frogs, like they don't got enough of an uphill battle, depleting their testosterone and increasing estrogen, chemically castrating 3/4 of the exposed male frogs, and turning 1 in 10 of those frogs into fully functional females with the ability to mate and lay eggs. Among humans, it is an endocrine disruptor, possibly carcinogenic, and has an epidemiological connection to low sperm levels in men. In human fetus, when exposure coincides with the development of the brain and reproductive organs, timing may be even more critical than the dose. 5 studies published in peer-reviewed journals have found evidence suggesting that just small amounts of atrazine in drinking water, including levels considered safe by federal standards, go figure, may be associated with birth defects, including skull and facial malformations and misshapen limbs. Also of great concern is the potential for atrazine to act synergistically with other pesticides to increase their toxic effects. Fertilizers are another agricultural waste found in runoff and is mostly comprised of nitrates. Septic systems, animal feedlots, industrial waste, and food processing wastes also leak nitrates. Nitrates, or the NO3 compounds, in high levels can poison infants, giving them the blue baby syndrome. This is because the baby's skin turns blue or lavender from the body being unable to process enough oxygen. High nitrate content in water may also contribute to birth defects in pregnant women, and people with heart or lung disease may even be more sensitive to toxic nitrate effects. Up until the mid-1970s, landfills or dumps were just open pits where people brought their garbage. It wasn't until the mid-1970s that groundwater testing indicated that toxic substances such as mercury, lead, bacteria, viruses, benzene, motor oil, and other VOCs were exiting the landfill through rainwater runoff. Landfills have since been re-engineered and use thick rubber linings to catch and help siphon off these spills. However, many old landfills and forgotten dumps are still disgorging hundreds of gallons of toxic substances into rivers and groundwater and will continue to do so for years. And then there's mine runoff. Mining is a Pandora's box. It can bring precious and useful metals from deep within the earth, but it can also release toxic heavy metals into the water supply. Some mine runoff is toxic enough to kill all the aquatic life it comes in contact with, along whole sections of streams and rivers. The Iron Mountain Mine Superfund site in Northern California originally opened in the 1860s for iron, silver, gold, copper, zinc, and pyrite. After closing in 1963, mine waste, or tailings, and the open pit of the mine itself has caused rain runoff of mineral and metals, sometimes green or yellow liquid, to surge into streams and groundwater. When pyrite is exposed to water and oxygen, it forms sulfuric acid. This harsh acid reacts to mineral in the mountain and leaches out copper, cadmium, iron, zinc, and other metals. Now, in spite of the efforts by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, these metals and the sulfuric acid make their way into the Upper Sacramento River system, affecting about 70,000 people. Other mines, such as coal mines, release similar corrosive metal-contaminated runoff into lakes and rivers. These can contain arsenic, lead, mercury, chromium. In addition to being carcinogenic, these affect the brain, the liver, the kidneys, your skin, your bones, even your teeth. Small amounts of lead can cause significant health problems, especially in children. Problems range from behavioral problems and learning disabilities to the extreme end of seizures and even death. Children 6 years old and under are most at risk. Sewers, your worst pipe dream. When sewer systems were first installed throughout the United States all the way back in 1855, they were hailed as being the most significant improvement of the century for our entire country. At the time, they were in fact a miracle compared to the muck and raw sewage left to pool in city streets. A century and a half later, however, they had become an expensive polluting curse for 40 million people in 32 states. Combined sewage systems collect raw sewage from household sewer mains and stormwater runoff and from street drains. Under normal circumstances, rainwater will join the sewage stream and flow into the public watershed treatment plant. But in times when there is a lot of rain or flooding and the wastewater treatment plant cannot handle the volume, the water containing both rainwater and sewage is allowed to be released directly into streams or rivers as a, quote, combined sewer overflow, end quote. With city populations on the rise, the more sewage entering the waste system as it takes less and less rainwater to overburden that system. Where a combined sewer overflow in a rainstorm was once rare, now it has become a regular necessity. Though these types of systems are no longer being built in modern subdivisions or other communities, there are many cities in Maine, New York, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, and even Illinois that still rely on them. According to an EPA report, combined sewage overflows are a major water pollution concern for 772 cities. Although some major cities, like New York City and Philadelphia, have combined sewer overflow systems, most communities with the CSO have fewer than 10,000 people. An estimated 750,000 sewer overflows totaling 3 to 10 billion gallons of untreated wastewater and rainwater occur in the United States annually. In addition to human and animal wastes, it contains microbial pathogens, suspended solids, chemicals, and trash. outflowing wastewater also carries nutrients that deplete dissolved oxygen in seawater. This poisons, obviously, shellfish beds and beaches. The EPA estimates about 3,500 to 5,500 gastrointestinal illnesses each year are caused by sewers spilling pollution into swimming waters. Other estimates suggest hundreds of thousands of people each year are sickened by microbial pathogens, viruses, and parasites in drinking water supplies. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that the nation's drinking water systems require an investment of, you ready for this? $334.8 billion with a B dollars over the next 20 years, with most of the money needed to improve transmission and distribution systems, with $50.6 billion needed to reduce the nation's combined sewer overflows volume by just 85%. In 1987, Boston, Cambridge, Chelsea, Somerville had a total of 84 uncontrolled combined system overflows that discharged into Boston Harbor and into the Charles, Mystic, and Neponset Rivers. As of September 2010, 27 CSOs have been closed. Average bacterial levels in the Charles have decreased by 80%, while the other rivers have shown little or no improvement. Some communities have increased sewer rates in an attempt to raise funds to upgrade their sewer systems. Some have chosen design shortcuts that initially save money and seemed at the time inconsequential, but ultimately proved dangerous. In Coralville, Iowa, the city's wastewater superintendent was injured while using a blowtorch to melt ice off a roof hatch of a sludge-holding building so workers could empty the tank inside. Since the holding building was not ventilated, what piled up? You're right, methane from the tank had built up inside and put pressure just below the roof. When the torch ignited the gas, it blew the roof clean off the building, and the explosion was felt for miles around. Most of America's sewer lines are over 100 years old now and are definitely falling apart. Upgrading the pipes to modern materials is extremely expensive. Also, the process is profoundly disruptive to neighborhoods and cities because often streets must be torn up and residents cannot flush their toilets. In some part of the country, century-old sewer lines have been discovered that are still being used, still using the original 19th century wooden pipes. Some lines are either poorly mapped or not mapped at all and are only discovered when they break, which can be a rude awakening, a rude surprise, given that some residential pump systems handle 321,000 gallons of untreated sewage per day. The enormous cost to install new sewers and treatment facilities forces communities to seek federal aid. Unfortunately, that funding, well, is fast drying up. Federal spending cuts for the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, which provides low-cost loans primarily for sewage infrastructure upgrades, are in the pipeline. As of February 9, 2011, the House Appropriations Committee announced it would cut $700 million from the fund. Your tap water fixed on failure. As mentioned earlier, more and more municipal water systems are draining less water from aquifers and taking more water from local rivers, lakes, and reservoirs. The water utilities purify water through a series of steps. First, they screen leaves, branches, and large pieces of trash and junk. Next, settling allows solids suspended in the water to sink to the bottom of the tank. The water is then clarified, which allows evaporation of some dissolved compounds. The next step is the softening and pH adjustment. Finally, the water is chlorinated, but over the years, more and more health problems have been linked to chlorine treatment. Chlorination has long been an accepted means and the cheapest to ensure that drinking water is free of harmful bacteria, parasites, even algae. Over the years, however, more and more health problems have been linked to chlorine treatment. Chlorine can react with organic matter in the water and form dangerous compounds such as chloroform. Dr. Joseph M. Price, a medical doctor, argues in his latest paper, quote, "Chlorine is the greatest crippler and killer of modern times. It is an insidious poison, end quote. Chlorinated drinking water has also been shown to elevate the average plasma cholesterol and serum thioxine in 19 healthy men. This study conducted in the late 1900s, quote, demonstrated that chlorine in drinking water at concentrations potentially consumed by humans may raise the total plasma cholesterol and serum thioxine, end quote. In short, the chlorinated water from your tap may be elevating amounts of bad cholesterol in your body that can ultimately give you a heart attack. Purified tap water leaves the local treatment center and heads into the pumps and water mains. Whether it actually gets to your sink is not beginning to look more and more like a matter of luck. Many of America's drinking water mains, mostly iron, were installed around World War II. Nearly 70 years later, the EPA estimates that almost 250,000 water supply mains break every year. That's over 700 a day, wasting millions of gallons of fresh water. Like sewer pipes, many of these are poorly documented when it comes to their location, their depth, even their composition. Nothing is known, nothing about their condition. Some small city utilities know they have many leaks, falling pressure, and muddy water, but they don't take action right away. They can't afford the cost of actively managing their aging water systems, and they can't afford to disrupt local business by digging up all the pipes. Their default diagnostic repair plan, you ready for this? To wait for water mains to break. Some small city utilities know they have many leaks, falling pressure, and muddy water, but they don't take action right away. They can't afford the cost of actively managing their aging water systems, and they can't afford to disrupt local business by digging up all the pipes. Their default diagnostic repair plan, you ready for this? To wait for water mains to break. The USGS calculates that 1.7 trillion, with a T, 1.7 trillion gallons of water is leaked per year at an annual cost nationally of $2.6 billion. Broken water mains are not only expensive to repair or to replace, but they also cause millions of dollars in damage. In 2006, more sinkholes were reported in the United States than any other year, and many of them formed when pipes broke underground and caused sinkholes. The Los Angeles Times reported, quote, in LA, a broken water main created a sinkhole 30 feet deep and shut down half of the Pacific Coast Highway near Malibu. At the same time, a broken sewer pipe shut down the adjacent beach, end quote. If you've ever been on that stretch of highway or that beach, you know it's beautiful, but not if it's eaten up by a sinkhole. Additionally, in 2009, a sinkhole swallowed the LA fire engine because a broken water main caused the already fragile ground to subside. You can even check out this video on YouTube. The one force that can thoroughly devastate a city water supply for weeks is not too many leaks or too little water. Believe it or not, it's having too much water all at once. Flooding chokes the intakes of municipal water treatment centers with toxic runoff, leachate, mud, fertilizers, herbicides, bacteria, and so much more. It forces these contaminants into the groundwater where they can pose problems for days. Now, since most water utilities are situated next to rivers, flooding can sometimes swamp pump buildings and water purifying processing areas, forcing them to close down. So too can floodwaters shut down sewage treatment plants, rendering them useless for weeks. In 2008, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, experienced a 500-year flood, flooding that only has a 1 in 500 chance of occurring each year. On June 13th, the Cedar River crested at 31.3 feet above flood stage. Roughly 5,900 homes flooded, with 10,000 residents displaced when it happened. All but one of the city's 48 alluvial aquifer wells flooded with polluted river water. Only through a massive sandbagging effort was the last well kept pumping. Water sewage restrictions were imposed. Bathing and laundry were banned for a total of 5 days. Meanwhile, the wastewater plant was closed and sealed. The entire city was without sewer service. Flushing a toilet sent raw waste into the Cedar River or out onto the streets. the wastewater plant would not be up and working again for 73 days, and only then at partial capacity. Many people in Iowa and the upper Midwest learned that year that what you put in the water, you get back in the water. You ever wonder what your neighbors are sharing with you in their water? Water traders. Is privatization the only solution? You have to admit, water infrastructure is failing. Water treatment plants do not have the technology to protect citizens from 21st century contaminants. As municipalities, states, and federal government run out of funds, investment in long-term sustainable solutions is almost non-existent. Citizens are clamoring for legislation to clean up our waters, but they must do battle with corporate lobbyists with far deeper pockets. As the future of clean water looks increasingly grim, privatization may offer a glimmer of hope. But at what price? In the 1990s, a handful of multinational corporations began buying out public utilities and acquiring water rights. In some places, such as Bolivia, these rights included water in aquifers and water from the sky. Over the years, corporation-owned water rights have turned a free natural resource into a profitable commodity worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Today, around 7% of the world's population relies on multinational companies to provide them with safe drinking water. In Bolivia, South America's poorest country, the water deal arranged by the World Bank with Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco gave the American company the right to seize the homes of those that could not pay their water bills. In England and Wales, privatization of water utilities led to a 46% increase in price, decreased investment, and threats to public health through non-payment cutoff. Profits doubled in 8 years for the private companies, including the big E word, Enron, which had bought the British utility Wessex Water. In 2009, a French company, Veolia Water, spun off in 2000 from Vivendi Entertainment, made over $17 billion with a B, $17 billion, including recent water deals with China and Russia. GDF Suez, another French water utility company, made around $772 million in profit in 2010, much of it from its U.S. subsidiary, United Water Resources, which serves 7 million Americans. With official United Nations figures showing that 1 billion people lack access to clean drinking water, and more than double that number lack proper sanitation, water is fast becoming a commodity more valuable than oil. In April 2010, the Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development said, quote, "Putting a price on water will make us aware of the scarcity and make us take better care of it," end quote. Likely because of severe drought conditions, Australia has been a pioneer when it comes to water rights. It is currently the only nation to have a national water rights trading market. The state of California isn't far behind, however. It, too, has set up water trading markets, though on a smaller regional scale. Will the rest of the world soon follow suit? Liquid fear. Water in the age of terrorism. Following the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, the U.S. government quickly identified the American water supply as a potential target for terrorist attacks and sabotage. The National Council for Public-Private Partnerships cited in its December 2000 Technical Security and Countermeasures White Paper for water four specific areas of caution: physical damage, damage to chemical storage areas, contamination with a biological or chemical agent, and cyber terrorism. Since then, billions of dollars in lights, fencing, locks, sensors, guards, and alarms have been installed at local drinking water utilities and wastewater plants. But has it been enough? Ask yourself. Judging by the numerous acts of vandalism at water utility properties in recent years, it has not. In March of 2006, two teenagers cut through barbed wire and an alarm system to enter the Massachusetts water supply. Inside, they deposited a 5-gallon container of foul-smelling liquid atop a water storage tank. On May 12, 2010, vandals put rocks, brush, and construction debris into a sewer line in Austin, Texas, causing a 250,000-gallon raw sewage spill that contaminated private wells nearby. On February 11, 2011, vandals opened several fire hydrants in Newport, Minnesota, causing water pressure to drop. As a result, the city water system raised line pressure, pumping at a higher than normal rate. The high pressure cracked a water main, leaving 30 homes without water. Acts like these underlie that, despite the commitment of federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies, the water infrastructure is still very vulnerable. As these three limited incidents show, there was ample opportunity for a small-scale chemical or biological attack. Even though, as Jane's Chemobio Handbook states, quote, municipal water supplies are very difficult to contaminate to cause widespread casualties, end quote, the disruption and fear following a limited attack still accomplishes a terrorist goal. Water utilities rely on supervisory control and data acquisition software to help monitor and control water filtration, valve releases, chlorination, even distribution. Because of the systems they control, the SCADA systems are running all the time without backup or redundancy. Unfortunately as well, SCADA systems are far from perfectly secure and are continually undergoing fixes and patches to keep hackers out. In the meantime, itsecurityportal.com lists under its security trends for 2011, quote, there will be more targeting of SCADA facilities for ransom and extortion purposes, as well as, or even rather, than out-and-out espionage and sabotage, end quote. In other words, a hacker on the other side of the globe can turn the water's utility controls against itself. Once in the system, the hacker can shut off all water flow or contaminate it with wastewater, unless the municipality pays a ransom. Peak water. Why clean, safe water could soon be as valuable as oil. Before we go, remember that 60 to 70% by volume of the human body is comprised of water. Everything in our body relies on it. Our heart, our lungs, our eyes, even our blood is filled with water. There is nothing more important to the human being than the ability to have clean, fresh water. With all of the threats to the water supply identified in this report, isn't it time to protect yourself and your family from the whole list of attackers that are out there waiting to rob you of your clean water? On behalf of Bill Hyde and everyone at Solutions from Science, thank you so much for signing up for Peak Water, why clean, safe water could soon be as valuable as oil. I'm Brian Brody.